Welcome to Books and Beyond with your host, Alison. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library.
Nau mai, haere mai, kia ora, and welcome to Books and Beyond. This is your host, Alison, and I'm joined by the award-winning crime novelist, Paul Cleave. And now Paul's on the line from Christchurch. Kia ora, Paul.
Hi, Alison. How's it going up there?
Look, it's great up here, thanks. Thank you so much for being with us today.
No problem.
Paul has just released his latest novel, which is his 12th, and it's called The Quiet People, and it's published by Upstart Press. So congratulations, Paul.
Thanks.
Now, look, I've just read the book. It is so good. I just couldn't put it down. So I'm just going to describe the book in about a paragraph for our listeners.
Sure.
So don't worry, I won't spoil anything for them.
You're already off to a good start. The fact that you liked it, this is my favourite interview.
Oh, good. Now, I think everyone will. So now, the book is set in Christchurch, and it follows a successful husband and wife crime-writing duo whose child goes missing in mysterious circumstances. Now, the couple's long-running joke that if anyone could get away with murder, it would be a crime writer, or indeed a pair of crime writers, this joke comes back to haunt them because they quickly become prime suspects in their son's disappearance. Dot, dot, dot. So it's so compelling. Paul, I was wondering if we could start off. I wanted to ask you some questions about Christchurch, your hometown. So all of your novels are set in Christchurch, and as we know, it's a beautiful city, but it does have quite a dark underbelly. And I'm wondering if we'd be correct in describing your writing as Christchurch noir.
Yeah, I think that's actually a pretty good term, and weirdly, it's a term that some of my international publishers have been using over the last few years as well. But Christchurch definitely does have a dark underbelly. I mean, I've seen it, I've experienced it. You know, I remember walking home from town one night with a couple of friends, and there were three of us, and about 15 skinheads just started beating the crap out of us. Things like that have really informed my feeling of Christchurch, and you sort of put those things into the book, and you know, it is a dark city.
Yeah, it's a real city of contrasts, isn't it? So I guess would it be those sort of things that make Christchurch so ideal as a setting in your books?
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is that, you know, if you're writing a crime novel, and ultimately, like, Christchurch is my favourite city. Like, I've travelled a lot. It's my home. I would never want to live anywhere else but Christchurch. So I do love it, but it does have, you know, it has its good and it has its bad. But if you're writing a crime novel where horrible things are happening, it's got to have that kind of dark backdrop to, you're trying to pull the reader into this kind of horrible universe, and you know, having Christchurch as a bad Christchurch is all part of that.
Yeah, I guess that's right, because it would be hopeless if you'd made your city Shangri-La or some mythical perfect place, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly. If everyone's getting on and everyone's happy and the weather's always good, it's like, well, that's not really much of a crime novel.
That's right. Now, Christchurch holds a lot of trauma in its recent past, and I'm wondering if you can describe for us the thinking that goes into any decision about whether you include the earthquakes or do you include the terror attack in your fictional Christchurch.
Yeah, actually, you know what, there's not a lot of thinking involved there at all. I just don't do it. It's just especially the earthquakes, like, even, you know, even all these years later, it's still not something I want to put in the books. That's not saying that other people can't do that. Like, I know a lot of people, they do base books around, you know, historical events or actual current events or whatever. That's just not my thing. You know, I also had a timeline issue with the books as well, where the first, I think, seven or eight books all kind of happened within the space of a year. So you couldn't suddenly, you know, by book five or book six, have a character go, hey, you remember that earthquake none of us mentioned 5 books ago?
Oh, right.
Look at this building. It's fallen down. So that wasn't going to work anyway. But even so, it's just, you know, I mean, so many people have been hurt by that, by the shooting, and to sort of just, you know, I don't want to put that into a book to try to, because ultimately a crime novel, you're trying to entertain people, you know. But I'm not going to put those kind of things in there when people have suffered so much. So, and the other thing is you know, I should be able to come up with other things. I should be able to create a different universe. I should be able to create things that don't rely on those.
Yeah, oh, that's really interesting. Thanks for that. Now, in terms of your writing technique, you know, I was hooked from the first page, you know, from about the first sentence, and I just couldn't put the book down. And I think this is a great skill that you have. And I've been trying to work out how you make a book unputdownable. And I'm, you know, I've been wondering if it's to do with the length and the pace of your sentences and chapters. But so I'm kind of wanting to ask you how you do it, but I know you can't give away your trade secrets.
Yeah, it's one of those things that I don't really think about anymore. Like, you do want short, punchy sort of sentences. You sort of write for what the pace is at that time. You know, you've always got to keep in mind, okay, well, this is an action scene. Now's not the time to sort of, you know, remind people what somebody looks like, or, you know, or what this house looks like. You know, you're always trying to, like, get in and out of a scene quite quickly. So I do try to have punchy scenes, shorter chapters in some cases, but not all cases. Like, I mean, you're not always writing an action-y kind of scene, but, you know, ultimately you're always thinking, you know, you want the reader to turn the page, you want them to keep going, you want them to send you an email the following morning and complain because they stayed up to 2 a.m. they couldn't put the book down. You get that, and it's great, and it's always a really, really cool thing. But as to how I do that, like, it's at that point now where I don't really think about it anymore. It's just how I write.
Yeah, it's just how you do it. Yeah. I felt that another way that the story remains so dynamic is that, and I don't know whether this is done on purpose, but the narrative alternates between the character Cameron, who's the crime writer, in the first person, and then you've got the third person view of D.I. Rebecca Kent. And so it's kind of back and forth. And I felt that kept things really pacey.
Yeah, it's actually something I've done, I think, in many, I don't think all of the books, where I'll have a first-person character and then third-person other characters. So you're predominantly with the first-person one, who will have maybe like 60 or 70% of the book, and you kind of intersperse it with one or two others. It's a really cool thing that I like seeing in books. It's something that I've always done. But weirdly enough, with that book, and I've had others, like Blood Men is another example of it, The Cleaner was another example, the whole book was written with only the one character, only the first-person character. And then you get to the end of the book and you go, wow, there's something missing here. It's not the norm. It's not normally how people would write, but and it was the same with this one here, where I wrote the book and it came up short, and I thought I think it needs something else. And I thought, well, maybe I can give you know, Rebecca Kent her own chapters, and she's a character from other books.
She
is somebody I'd been wanting to write from her perspective for a while, and I thought, you know what, this is it. Give her her chapters, and then that brought the whole investigation into the book, and it became a very different thing.
Oh, right. Oh, that's interesting. And then, of course, you've got Cameron's inner voice that pops up throughout the book.
His author voice, yeah.
Yes, and the sort of anxious voice that's sort of saying, oh, no, this is going to go horribly wrong kind of thing.
Yeah, he I think he calls him Mr. What If.
Oh, Mr. What If, that's right.
Yeah, but that's what you do as a crime writer, like when his son first goes missing and he's like, he loses sight of him and he's like, what if someone's taken him? What if he's being put into the back of a van right now? And it becomes this thing through the book. It's always like, what if, and that's kind of what a crime writer does. Like when you're trying to come up with an idea, it's like, well, what if you if this happens, or what if I, you know? So that's actually, you know, you can always say that's what my job is. Like when I sit down, it's always about the what if.
Oh, right. That makes so much sense. Yeah. Now, other popular crime thrillers like the Lee Child books, for example, they're really plot-driven, and that gives them those really fast-paced, gripping storylines. But I kind of see your books as being very character-driven as well, because I feel as though we really get to know the characters with their flaws, flaws and all. And I wondered if this was a deliberate technique on your part to really flesh out your characters.
Yeah, it's something I always do. Like, I've read some books, not Lee's, but I mean, I do read Lee's books, but I wouldn't say his in this example, but I have read some books that are just purely plot-driven and are fast and are fun, but you don't come out of it with anything. And I remember Lee said this to me once, actually, years ago. He was saying, when you read a crime novel, it's often like a year later, someone will go, "What was that book about?" And you don't really remember the plot as well as you remember the characters. So I always want to have characters who, you know, a year or two after the book, you will still be thinking, "I wonder what ever happened to that guy? You know, where are they now?" So I always flesh the characters out. It doesn't always happen in a first draft or a second draft, but you know, as you go through the rewrites, you just try to put a bit more of them in there, a reason for what they're doing. You know, just make them more three dimensional,
right?
Relatable.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. And when we're talking about plot, I was going to ask you that when you begin writing a novel, do you map it all out on first, like on a giant big whiteboard or a spreadsheet, or do you just start writing and kind of let the characters and the setting guide you?
Yeah, there are both those ways are, out of all the authors I know, probably half of them do it one way, half of them do it the other. I do it the way where I got no idea what's going on. So I will just come up with an idea for either an opening chapter or a character, and then you just go, okay, let's just see where it goes. So at any given point, you kind of have an idea over the following maybe two or three chapters. But it's cool in the sense that you get the surprise because you don't know what's coming up, and you know you get to sort of be there for it. But it's difficult in the sense that you can get stuck very quickly. It's like, oh, I don't know what to do here.
Yeah, I guess you could reach a dead end and think, that's not going to work.
Well, it happens all the time, and generally what happens is you'll reach a dead end and you'll go, okay, there's something wrong here, and you sort of go back 5 or 10,000 words, and where your character went one way, you go, okay, what if they do this instead? You know, again, the what if.
That's the what ifs, isn't it?
Yeah. But you've gotten it wrong. Like Lee Child, for example, and Stephen King, for example, both those guys don't plot. They just sit down and go, let's just see what happens.
Oh, right. Oh, that's very interesting.
Whereas, like, Jeffrey Deaver, for example, he will have, I think he spends about 6 months just planning stuff, and he will have that sort of whiteboard, corkboard thing in his office with, you know, everything pinned up everywhere and all these connections, and then when he actually writes the book, it's a very quick process.
Oh, right. Oh, that's super interesting. Now, we were talking about the character, Detective Inspector Rebecca Kent, in this novel, and that as a recurring character, because she'd been injured in the line of duty in an earlier book, hadn't she? And
yep.
And you sort of told us how that you decided to put her into this one to add a bit more to it. But I was sort of wanting to ask you how you'd make that decision about having your earlier characters popping in to your later story, or how do you decide which one is going to pop in?
I think it's just being lazy. It's like I can either have to completely create somebody new, or I can go, you know what, let's just grab this person from this book. They need a turn, which is partly true, but also when you start populating the books with, because you know it's a small city, and when you start populating them with sort of background characters, it connects them all, and it's kind of fun as a reader when you go, oh hey, I know that guy, you know, even if it's just a very small character, it's always just it's fun. And Kent particularly was a character who I really liked. Because of, you know, she's in, I think, 3 or 4 books.
Yeah.
And she became, you know, she's quiet, has, the Quiet People is her, it's her outing, like it's her turn to shine. And she's in the next one too. I'm working on one at the moment, which is over half done, and she's one of the leads in that again. But she's going to be my go-to person for a while, I think.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. It gives something to look forward to, because I find her a wonderful character, and I think kind of by having the recurring characters, I think as a reader you develop a relationship with them. So it really you get a real buy-in to the story.
Yeah, you do, yeah. And then of course you start developing. You know, their circle, like, you know, what's going on in their lives, their friends, their family, you know, their house, so just little things to make them more of a, you flesh them out. You know, where in the previous books they were just there to sort of push the story along, like they were a vehicle, but now it's like, okay, well, let's introduce this person to the world.
Yeah. Oh, good. Oh, well, I'm really looking forward to reading more about D.I. Rebecca Kent. Now, Paul, I've got some questions to ask about you, yourself, the writer. Did you always want to be a writer?
Yeah, always since I was a little kid. But it's, you know, it's that thing where it's almost like saying you want to be Batman, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you have this idea what you want to do, but it's not realistic. And it's not like you're at school and you go, hey, I want to be a novelist growing up. It's not like the teachers are going to go, yeah, you do that, you know, because it just doesn't kind of happen. But, you know, but it was when I was 19, you know, when a friend said to me at the time, if you could do anything in the world, what would it be? And I was like, oh, you know, I'd be a writer. And they said, well, why don't you actually just do it? I was like, oh, that's an interesting question. Why don't I? So I did. I just started writing straight away. You know, I think that next day I started writing a horror novel. And I wrote a bunch of them too until I wrote The Cleaner. Like, I think I wrote like 7 or 8 kind of really horrible efforts, which you know, no one will ever see. But it gets you there. Like, I mean, you can't. It's all about the experience and learning and. You know, so yes, always, and still, you know, it's what I want to do.
You still want to do it. Oh, that's great. Yeah, it's a pity, really, that teachers, well, probably some do, but in general, you know, if you said to your English teacher, I want to be a writer, you usually are not going to get a huge amount of encouragement.
Yeah, that would say that. You know, you need a plan A and you do plan B as a hobby sort of thing.
Yes.
But, you know, it's hard to make a living from it.
Yeah. It's a bit like people say, well, do your accountancy degree first and then you can write in your spare time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Don't give up your day job.
Yeah, which is probably well-meaning often, but it can be a bit, it's not very encouraging, is it?
Exactly.
Yeah. So, what would you say were early influences on your writing? So I'm kind of wondering about favourite authors that you would have had when you were younger.
Oh, boy, you know, I really cannot remember that far back as far as what I was reading as a teenager. Like, it was always just sort of more adventure novels. Like, I wasn't reading crime. I actually didn't read a crime novel until I was, you know, my mid-20s, I guess, almost 30. I was always just reading adventure stuff, and then, you know, when I was a school kid, when I came out of that and I started sort of like my adult life, I spent the first 4 or 5 years reading only Stephen King.
Right.
I mean, as soon as I read his collection at the time, everything he had, you know, and then I was like 22, 23, and it's like, okay, what else is there? And that's when you start looking, okay, who else writes horror? Because it's all I did was horror. Wanted to read. And then there's a show on Netflix at the moment, I don't know if you know it, but it's called Mindhunter, and it's about it's kind of sort of a fictionalized version of real events where these guys who created the FBI Behavioral Response Unit back in the 70s, they drove around all these prisons and they were interviewing real-life serial killers, which sort of helped them build up a database. So in a sense that everyone who does a profile now comes back to what these folks learned, you know, 40, 50 years ago. And when I was in my mid-20s, I remember, actually a little bit before that, I found those books. This is like in the late 90s, early 2000, I found those books that this Netflix show was based on, and I read them, and I realized this is, you know, this crime stuff is real horror, you know. And so I switched then from writing horror to writing crime, because that's kind of how I spare. Like, if you lose a loved one to a homicide, you know, that's horror.
Yeah.
So I guess more than anything, sorry, the part of the books that influenced me the most as to what I write now.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, because there's that true crossover, really, isn't there, between horror and crime, probably depending on your point of view or what your experience is. Now, you've are someone who's always enjoyed travelling overseas, before the pandemic, of course. Have you been missing getting away from New Zealand?
Yeah. I'm normally away around about 10 to 12 weeks a year. And so last year was the first time I haven't travelled in many, many years. So it was tough, and I had a big year last year planned as well, including, you know, China and Israel and Morocco and Norway. I was going to Machu Picchu and Brazil, and it was, you know, I had a cruise planned in the Caribbean. It was going to be awesome, and of course it all fell apart, and it ended up spending like a couple of months last year battling with airlines and travel agents and man, it was just a nightmare. The amount of times travel agents and airlines would just blatantly lie to you, it was a horrible experience. But you know, that's you know, aside. But yeah, I miss the travel. You know, I don't know when I'll get away again. I'm hoping next year.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big part of the job. You go to festivals, you know, you sign books, you meet people, you hang out with your author friends and et cetera, and it's all, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong, it's great that we're here in New Zealand, like, I mean, safest country in the world, I think, and so I'm, you know, in some ways you can't complain, but I do miss, you know, those other things.
Yeah, oh, I bet you do, because they are part of the job, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
I've been thinking that when you write these sort of dark psychological thrillers that you do, that you're so good at, it must be very draining. And I'm wondering how you take care of your own well-being while you're writing. And I guess travel could have been part of that. But is this where the frisbee comes in handy?
Yeah, I mean, I try to stay in shape a little bit. So, yeah, I'm at the gym 3 or 4 days a week, and, you know, I go running a couple of times a week if I can. So that helps me unwind. But generally, I'm okay. Like, I mean, it's just writing is tiring. Like, sitting in your office for 8 hours a day, just putting words on a page is draining. But as far as the actual draining, because it's quite psychologically dark, that doesn't really affect me in that way. I can, you know, I don't look at it like that. I just look at it as a job. The same way, like, if I watch a horror movie or a crime movie, you know, I sort of, they don't have any effect on me anymore, because I just go, well, I can just picture, but, you know, once you see behind the curtain, you know, that's all you see from now on. So when I'm writing a book, it's just like, okay, so I'm in dark mode now, and then 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock rolls around, I'll be like, all right, let's go watch Seinfeld or something.
Right. So it's just another day at the office, really, for you.
Yeah, well, and I enjoy it. And it's weird, because I know you're writing the darkest kind of stuff, but I enjoy doing it, so I don't have any kind of issue. And, you know, I don't hear any voices or anything, so until that happens, so I'll keep doing it.
Yeah. Oh, no, it seems to be working well. So I was going to ask you how you'd structure a typical writing day. And you, so would you be sitting at a desk for 8 hours, which does sound exhausting.
Yeah, I have been lately. It depends on where you're at and what stage of a book. Like I started a book, a new book, last month, and it's been going really well. It's over halfway now in 4 weeks, which is quite good.
Wow.
But I'm writing, like I'm in the office like 8 hours, 10 hours a day, just going for it. So, but then, you know, when it's done, I can basically take 6 months off or 9 months off to do other things, you know, gardening, reading, whatever. You're always coming back for editing but and other things, in which case you're in the office for like an hour or two a day. But there's no real structure normally. It's just, you know, get up. If it's a gym day, go to the gym, come home, then write. If it's not a gym day, get up, have breakfast, write, you know. So, you know, there's that thing when your hobby becomes your job as well. It's pretty cool. Like you want to do it.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I know that with my own work too. Sometimes it doesn't really feel like going to work because it's such a cool. You're doing such a cool thing.
Yeah. And you work every day. Like when this new book, I think I'm at day 27 or 28 in a row now, where it's 8 hours a day, but it's fine. Like I want to do it, so I don't think, oh my god, I want time off. It's like, no, I don't. I just want to, you know, like I sort of say no to all my friends, whatever they want to do. I'm not socializing, I'm not doing much, just get back into the book, because it's a momentum thing for me. Which things are going well, like I gotta stick with it. As soon as I get stuck or don't do a day or two of work, then I'm done. Then it can take me months to get back into it. So,
right,
just,
yeah.
Just, while it's there, go for
just
it.
Just go for it, yeah. Now, Paul, I've noticed some other things about your books, because they're bestsellers and you've been translated into about 20 languages, it seems. What I notice in your writing, there are a few American terms that come through. So I'm wondering if you're writing for an American audience, or is this just an example of the evolution of New Zealand English?
It's not that at all. I think there's two things it could be. It could be that you're reading an American version.
Okay.
Because what used to happen is when my primary publisher was New Zealand for the first 4 books, then everything was written in, you know, with British English, and that was fine. Then when my American publisher became my primary publisher, then everything got written in American English. So not just the spelling, but the terminology.
Some of the terms, yeah.
And so all the American books have that. Then when the book came out here, it was re-edited to get rid of those Americanisms and go back into British English. But there's always going to be a couple of things that don't get caught, that slip through, because, you know, it's 120,000 words there, so you can't get it all back to New Zealand. I mean, you do your best. You always hope that you get them all, but it's, you know, there'll be some. So it could be that's what's happened, where you've read a couple of things where it's slipped through, or it could be that you're actually just reading the American version.
Oh, right, yeah. And, I mean, our languages are really collide, or, you know, we're getting closer and closer to the American English anyway, aren't we? So
yeah. But people get upset about it, though. Like, I mean, I've, you know, so many emails or messages over the last few years where people get really abusive about it. Like one woman was, she said she was punching her pillow. Another guy said that his dad would be ashamed of me for selling out, and he'd roll in his grave.
Oh.
Kind of stuff. And you just write back and you go, yeah, because you've bought it from Amazon or something. Or so it's different, yeah.
Yeah, well, that'll teach you for buying from Amazon. Yeah, you should have bought local.
Yeah, yes. I think people are pretty good. Once I explain to them, it makes sense. Like, yeah,
yes.
Every market you want it to be catered for that market.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, this is so interesting. Look, Paul, I feel as though I could keep talking to you for another half an hour, but we're pretty much at the end of our session today. So it's been so good having you on here. I've been speaking with Paul Cleave about his new book, The Quiet People. Look, it's a compelling, suspenseful and riveting thriller, and it's going to leave you stunned, I can guarantee it. So look, I highly recommend that people buy a copy or two or three from their local bookstore. Thanks for your time today, Paul, and all the best for this book.
Thanks, Alison.
Thank you. And to our listeners, thanks for tuning in today. Haere rā, ka kite anō.
program was brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/booksandbeyond. Every day, every day.